800-282-3255. God bless you, and don't let the seducer take you down.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IR and its advertisers or affiliates.
Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Galen Ross, who's an old friend who's written a book. Well, he publishes one book called Who's Who in the Elite, which we carry. It goes into the background of the people who really run the world, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Council on Foreign Relations. That's Who's Who in the Elite, a very important book. But we're going to be talking this evening about his book on the elite serial killers, the death of Abraham Lincoln, of JFK, RFK, and MLK. Of course, that's John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and, of course, Martin Luther King. So understand, ladies and gentlemen, that, you know, you look back to the period when President Kennedy was killed, and then his brother, and then Martin Luther King, and we were in the middle of a war in Vietnam. It was much, much worse after John Kennedy was killed, because John Kennedy didn't want us to get involved in the war in Vietnam. But the people who are working behind the scenes, who are really running things, wanted a major distraction, wanted to enter America into a war that we would never lose, where millions of people would die. We talk about the 58,000 Americans who died, but we never talk about the 1 million South Vietnamese and 2 million North Vietnamese who were killed during that war. I wonder why. And then, of course, the 1.5 to 2 million Cambodians who died as a direct result of that war. We never talk about that sort of thing. And then there are so many unanswered questions about the things that occurred during that time. Well, I will tell you, most of this was simply a distraction to keep us from knowing, recognizing that there were people who were going to change America during that time. It was during that time they took God and prayer out of our schools in 62 and 63, and they found a woman had a right to an abortion. They changed our immigration laws, which part of the movement towards the destruction of America, changing the immigration laws. And Teddy Kennedy said, why, this is not going to change the demographics of our society. But as always, Teddy Kennedy lied. The whole idea was to produce a multicultural, multilingual society so we could merge into this world government. Well, tonight we're going to be talking about the death of Bobby Kennedy, Senator Kennedy. And, of course, the question is, why was he killed? But even more, have we been told the truth? And what we find as you begin studying the death of Martin Luther King, you've never heard the whole truth about that. You've never heard about the trial that was subsequently held by the King family, where the jury that heard all of the evidence decided the government was primarily responsible for the murder of Martin Luther King, a government hit operation, CIA military. But of course, not one word of that in the media after the jury came in with the decision. And then, of course, the murder of Robert Kennedy. Well, I'm going to let Galen tell us that story because it's a fascinating story that every American should hear and few ever have. Galen, thank you so much for being with us again.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Stan.
All right. Well, why don't you tell us about the murder of Bobby Kennedy?
Okay. At 12:15 p.m. on June the 5th, 1968,
Can you speak up just a little louder, Galen? You're just a little soft.
I've got it turned up as far as I can get it.
Are you on a headset or a hard?
Yeah, I'm on a headset.
Okay, is there any way you can get onto a regular telephone because the headsets don't come through so well?
Okay, hold on.
Okay, fine. Well, we'll get Galen onto a regular telephone because I want you to hear his story. It's an important story.
Is that any better?
Oh, that's so much better. Thank you so much.
Well, now I just barely can't hear you.
All right, fine. Well, how is that now? Can you hear me all right?
Just barely.
All right, go right ahead. Tell us about Bobby Kennedy.
Okay, at 12:15 p.m. on June 5th, 1968, Bobby Kennedy was going through the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. And when he reached the steam tables, he was being guided through the kitchen by the maitre d', Paul Euchre. And when he reached the steam tables, Paul Euchre felt someone trying to get around him on one side, and he thought someone was trying to shake Bobby's hand, but it was actually Sirhan Sirhan with a .22 caliber 8-shot revolver. Well, Roosevelt Greer was there beside the two, and when he saw the gun, well, Roosevelt grabbed the gun and started beating it against the steam table. But Sirhan was able to fire all 8 shots, and in my book I count for all eight shots. But none of them hit Bobby. I believe 4 of them hit people, and then the other 4 hit various parts of the room. But there's a fellow standing behind Bobby that was also under CIA mind control, and Sirhan was under mind control. But this fellow behind Bobby, when Sirhan fired his first shot, that was his trigger to pull his 9-shot .22 caliber revolver and start shooting it to Bobby. Well, one shot went through the padding of his jacket on the right side and didn't break the skin. The next shot was under his armpit, came out right below his throat. The next shot was about the center of his back, about 4 inches below the shoulder. And the last shot was the muzzle of the gun was 1 inch from his head and 1 inch behind his right ear. And the Thomas Noguchi coroner's report, and I include a certified copy of the coroner's report in my book, gives the direction of each of those shots and where they came from, and they were all from down low and upward direction. And of all the people that were in the pantry that day, no one said that Sirhan got any closer than about 3 feet from Bobby and was always in front of him, never behind him. So it's physically impossible for Sirhan to have killed Bobby.
All right, fine. Well, you hang on there. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest this evening is Galen Ross, and we're talking about the murder of Senator Robert Kennedy. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Galen Ross is actually has researched this rather extensively. And, of course, Saran, of course, was standing in front of Robert Kennedy. He had his gun. He fired 8 shots. He had, and even though Rosie Greer apparently had grabbed his gun arm, was trying to get the gun away from him, pounding it on the table. Why, of course, Saran shot 4 people. But not Bobby Kennedy. He also set 4 other shots, and Galen in his book tells you exactly where those bullets went. But the thing is that there was a man standing behind Robert Kennedy and to the right. And he pulled his gun as well. In fact, somebody there actually said that he saw this man shoot Bobby Kennedy. But, of course, the FBI and the investigator said, oh, no, you didn't see what you thought you saw. You just imagined that. But there were 4 bullets that hit Senator Kennedy from behind. At least 3 of them, were serious wounds. And the last one, of course, entered the senator's head. Just behind into the his right ear, and that was the bullet, of course, that killed him. And, of course, the bullet was fired from about 1 inch away, according to the Thomas DiGucci's autopsy report. And in the book, Elite Serial Killers, you'll see a certified copy of the autopsy report. How did you get that autopsy report, Galen?
I just barely can't hear you, Stan.
Oh, I'm sorry. How did you get the autopsy report?
I wrote to the L.A. Coroner's office and asked for a copy of it, and I think it cost me $75 or something like that, and they sent me a certified copy.
All right, fine. And so you actually have a certified copy right there in your book. And
yes,
people can read the book, read the autopsy report from Thomas DiGucci, who is the coroner. Then how could they possibly have convicted Saran of the crime if he was standing in front and yet the bullets that hit Robert Kennedy came from behind? That's impossible. Galen, can you hear me?
I just barely can. Do you mind if I put the headset back on?
You go ahead. Put the headset back on.
Okay, hold on.
Because, of course, the important thing, of course, is that there is no way that the bullets could have hit Senator Kennedy from behind when Saran was in front of them. That would be the most obvious thing. But, of course, unfortunately, it doesn't matter what the facts are. All right, fine. So, so why weren't these facts brought out at the trial? Why is it that almost no one in the general population understands that the bullets were fired from behind that killed Senator Kennedy and they couldn't have come from Saran's gun?
Well, the FBI and the LAPD were all in on this. It was a conspiracy to do this, and so they covered up evidence. They refused to interview key witnesses. They destroyed evidence, all sorts of things to prove that Sirhan was the shooter.
The lone gunman. Right. Go right ahead.
And they didn't want to investigate it anymore. In fact, the real shooter was named Thane Eugene Cesar. And he was interviewed several times by the FBI and LAPD, but always as a witness, never as a shooter.
And so they basically just covered up the truth, and they had their patsy. They sent him to prison, and he's been there for 40 years.
That's right. And there was a lady in a polka dot dress that was there in the pantry, and she was seen drinking coffee with Sirhan just before Bobby came in, and she probably put Rohypnol or some other amnesia-inducing drug in his coffee, because he has been interviewed many times and also under hypnosis, and he has completely lost about 1 hour of his time, or maybe a little bit more, that he can't recall regardless of what he tries to do. And so it was amnesia that was induced to prevent him from remembering that.
Now, of course, the tragic situation is, of course, that the American people have never been allowed to know the truth. Now, do you think that Saran was some sort of a Manchurian candidate who'd been programmed to do what he did?
He's probably the best example of the Manchurian candidate that we know of.
And, of course, the thing is that this has been totally covered up by the media. And my understanding is that Saran Saran, of course, was involved himself with studying the occult before that, that he was a disciple of Polina Petrovna Blavatsky. Had you ever heard that?
No, but I suspect that the CIA had searched him out to be the candidate, and so they may have had him do a lot of things to get ready for this killing.
And, of course, the thing is that Saran Saran, he was Palestinian, so they could say, well, the reason he wanted to kill Bobby Kennedy was because Bobby Kennedy was pro-Israel and he was a Palestinian, and so that's why he did it. They had to have a reason why Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy. They had to have an excuse why Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, the excuse at that time was that Jack Ruby had seen a billboard that said "Impeach Earl Warren" from the John Birch Society, and he figured that somehow Lee Harvey Oswald had to be affiliated with the John Birch Society, and that's why he had to kill him. Or the other explanation was, well, he didn't want Jackie Kennedy, who he just had loved and admired, to have to go through a trial, where Lee Harvey Oswald was tried. So that's why he had to kill Lee Harvey Oswald, was to protect Jackie Kennedy. And, of course, the real reason was because Jack Ruby was involved with the mafia, and he was ordered by Sam Giancano, who is the godfather of the mafia, to kill Lee Harvey Oswald, or, of course, he would be tortured to death and his family would be tortured to death. It was one of those offers you get from the mafia that you can't refuse. If you want to verify what I'm saying, the book Double Cross by Chuck Giancano, will tell you exactly what I've told you, but of course you'll never hear that from Rush Limbaugh or anyone else. Anyway, Galen, is there anything else we should cover as far as the murder of Bobby Kennedy? Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Yeah, there was the side issue on Carlos Marcellus, who was the head of the mafia in New Orleans. Bobby had been trying to put Carlos in prison for a number of years, and he wasn't able to get any hard evidence on him. But Carlos said that he was an immigrant from Guatemala instead of Sicily, where he really came from. So Bobby hit on a hot idea. He would just have him arrested and export him to Guatemala. And when they arrived at the airport in Guatemala, they put he and his attorney in a truck. They had on their business suits, and they drove them deep into the jungle in a dirt, muddy road, and made them get out at the end of that road and walk back to civilization. And so Carlos really didn't have any good feelings about Bobby.
Maybe he didn't, but because I don't think that, do you think that Carlos actually would have figured this thing out all on his own? He had to have the help of the FBI. He had to have the help of the Los Angeles Police Department. Obviously, he had help, if he had anything to do with it. He had help at the highest levels, the American government, the CIA, and the FBI.
Carlos Marcellus and the other mafia people were there. There was strictly a business deal with them. There was a contract, but the contract was issued by the high rollers in the United States at the time, including Johnson.
All right. And, of course, the one thing was that Bobby Kennedy would have become president of the United States, and, of course, he would have gotten to the bottom of who had killed his brother. The only way he could do anything was, of course, to get to be the president and then, of course, call for another investigation of the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. So let's get to the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, because I think that's the important part of this whole story.
Okay, John F. Kennedy was in Dallas on the 22nd of November 1963, and he had actually been lured to Dallas by Johnson and the other people behind the killing, because they knew that once he came to Texas, he was under Johnson's control, and they controlled everything there at that time. And so, of course, JFK didn't know about that trap, but he went along with it. And they actually actually changed the route of the motorcade so that it would go right through Dealey Plaza. And the reason for that is they turn right, and then they got down to about another block, and they had to take about a 120-degree turn to the left. It meant that the limousine would have to come almost to a halt to make that turn, and then slowly started accelerating, and there was a group of the leaders behind the killing were on the second floor, and the one that was behind the or that was in control of the shooting was Cliff Carter. He was on the walkie-talkie radio, and
Was he a CIA? Who was he? Was he working for the mafia?
He was executive director and treasurer of the Democratic National Committee.
So he would have been very close to Lyndon Johnson.
And he was involved in most of Lyndon Johnson's activities.
And in other words, the Lyndon Johnson's murders is what you're speaking of.
That's right. If Johnson wanted someone killed, he would tell Cliff, and Cliff would either contact Mike Wallace or some other hitman, and he would take care of it.
Now,
Mike Wallace killed something like 17 people in Texas for Johnson.
Well, now, of course, how do you get the information? Where does the information come from about Cliff Carter being directing this? Because you've actually researched this. You've talked to some of the people who are actually involved, haven't you?
Yeah, I've interviewed six people that were there that day. Two of them were in the secret meeting that Murchison's Night Fork Ender was killed. And the others were there socially. At the same meeting at the Murchison's house.
All right, hang on.
Everybody confirmed the same thing. One of my sources was Mappin Duncan Brown.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Galen Ross. He's talking about how he got the information he has on what really happened when John Fitzgerald Kennedy was killed, who was really behind that. And, of course, he had the opportunity, as I have had, to actually interview Marilyn Duncan Brown. And why don't you tell the story that she tells? Who was she? Why is she important?
Madeline Brown was Lyndon Johnson's mistress for 21 years and gave birth to his only known son. And she loved him dearly. And but I became acquainted with Madeline about 9 years ago. And every time I'd go to Dallas, we'd have lunch or dinner together. And we would talk about the assassination. And So one day she finally said, Galen, I've known you long enough that I think I can trust you. I need to really tell you the whole story. And I said, well, if you'd like to do that, we'll go right ahead. And so she did, and then later agreed to do that on video. So I produced a two-hour video titled The Clint Murchison Meeting. And she goes into her life as Johnson's mistress, and then also it was in the details of what happened on November 21st at Clint Murchison's house at that social event where there were about 50 people were in attendance or more. And about half of them were members of the press, including Helen Thomas, who was there. But she has never reported anything about that social event. There's another lady, Val M., was a social reporter for the Dallas Morning News, and I have a copy of her article that she wrote the next day, or that was published the next day, and she never mentioned the Clint Murchison event. And there were world movers and shakers there, and so it turns out that the media are included in these big events if they will keep their mouth shut. And also, some of them realize that if they talk about it, they'll lose their life.
Of course. Now, what actually happened at this meeting at Cliff Murchison's house on the 21st of November?
Well, it started about roughly 8 o'clock, and everyone was there except Johnson. And around 11:30 or 11:45, something like that, Johnson came through the front door, and Clint Merson stood up and said, "Okay, man, we can have our meeting now." And so 25 men went into the conference room and closed the door. And Cliff Carter was running the meeting. And let me just go down the list of the people that were in that secret meeting. It was at Clint Merson's house, so he was there. H.L. Hunt was there, the richest oil man in the United States at that time. Lyndon Johnson came in a little bit later, but he did go into the secret meeting. George Brown was there. He was the owner of Brown and Root. A fellow named John J. McCloy, at the time, was chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Chase Manhattan Bank, and former high governor of Germany after World War II.
And also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, we might add.
That's right. He's chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he was a Rothschild agent.
All right. Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Galen Ross. He's talking about the meeting that was held on the 21st of November, the day before President Kennedy was killed, on the 22nd of November, 1963. The information came from Madeleine Duncan Brown. Galen has a video, actually, of her telling this story. We actually have a two-hour interview with Madeleine Duncan Brown in our JFK assassination update, a four-tape set. We think it's a very important issue because Madeleine was there at the meeting that night. She didn't go to the inner meeting with the inner sanctum, where there were about 25 men who went in after Lyndon Johnson arrived about a little bit late in the evening. But there at the meeting, of course, was Clint Murchison, because it was his house. There was a man named Cliff Carter, who, of course, was in charge of Lyndon Johnson's assassination, John McCloy, a former chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, former High Commissioner in Germany, and of course, you have... Well, you go ahead and list the other people who were at that meeting. Wasn't J. Edgar Hoover there?
Yeah, Richard Nixon was there.
Richard Nixon, of course, who had been defeated by Kennedy in a dishonest election. Nixon actually won the election, but Kennedy's family had actually bribed the people in Illinois to steal the election. So the mafia actually stole two states, and that gave Kennedy the election. And Nixon was obviously told, go ahead and accept your defeat. You'll become president one day. So certainly he was there that evening. Wasn't J. Edgar Hoover there?
Yeah, J. Edgar Hoover was there. And also his assistant and playmate, Clyde Tolson, was there. Earl Cabell was mayor of Dallas. Amon G. Carter, Jr. was there. John Connally was there. John Connally was governor of Texas at the time. Orrell Thornton was there. He was a former mayor of Dallas. W.O. Baxton was there. He was one of the major auto dealers there in Dallas. One of the shooters was there, Mac Wallace, Malcolm E. Mac Wallace. He was Johnson and Carter's hitman, a former manager of the purchasing department of Ling Temco Vaught, and they would put him on the payroll of different companies here and there just to have a place for him to earn an income. But he's really one of their main killers. Mac Wallace killed 17 people in Texas for Johnson and Carter. Cliff Carter was there. He was the executive director and treasurer of the Democratic National Committee and helped Johnson in most of his campaigns. And then you have three members of the mafia there. Carlos Marcello, or Marcellus. He was head of the New Orleans Mafia. Joe Savello was head of the Dallas Mafia. And Jack Ruby was owner of the Dallas Carousel Club and the killer of Lee Harvey Oswald. Another fellow that was there is a black fellow named Larry Campbell. He was Jimmy Hoffa's number one lieutenant. Jimmy couldn't be there that evening, so he sent Larry Campbell to represent him. And also the sheriff of Dallas County was there, Bill Ducker. And Cliff Peoples was a U.S. Marshal and later became a senior Texas Ranger. And so you had several members of law enforcement, several members of the mafia, several large contractors, oil company executives, bankers, and all there to discuss the cover-up of the murder that's going to take place the next day.
And, of course, you actually verified this, not only from Madeline Duncan Brown, but from somebody else who was there. Who
there was one fellow that was involved in the secret meeting, and I don't name him in my book, and I can't name him until he gives me permission to do so or until he passes away.
All right, so...
And there's another fellow that was in a secret meeting that I'm still trying to get an interview with him, so I can't reveal his name.
All right, fine. Because the thing is that they can't let the American people know that this was covered up by the CIA and by the FBI. They wanted to kill Kennedy. He said he probably had many reasons. Nixon wanted him because he stole the election from him in 1960. The military wanted him dead because they wanted to go into Vietnam. People of great wealth wanted to get rid of him. The oil people wanted to get rid of him because he was doing away with the oil depleted allowance. Others wanted to get rid of him because he wanted to get us back to a stable currency with silver backing. It had actually signed an executive order, 11110, that of course had a silver-backed currency and Federal Reserve notes. But, of course, you could not actually have that. Well, he wanted Treasury notes rather than Federal Reserve notes. So John Kennedy had to be killed, and he was, on November 22nd, 1963.
Also, one of the fellows that was in the secret meeting happened to be on the second floor of the Texas Cuba.
Hold that just a moment there. Of course, Gannon is basically saying there was another fellow who was actually there, who was on the second floor of the was that the Texas School Vault Depository Building?
Yes.
All right, and who was that?
I can't name that person.
All right, fine. But anyway, of course. What about the people on the grassy knoll? Where were they from?
From the grassy knoll was a fellow named Jack Grimm. He was operating radio. He was a wealthy oil man, and he was always trying to become famous. He tried to locate the Titanic. He tried to locate the abominable snowman or the Yeti. He was running the radio, and then John Ernst from El Paso was one of the shooters. His nickname was Crooked John. And then Cloud Faust was another hitman and friend of Jack Grimm. And so you have two shooters and a radio operator behind the picket fence. Then on the second floor of the Dowtex building, back behind the limousine, you had one shooter, Eugene Hale Brading, and one unidentified radio operator. And then on the roof of the Dallas County Records building, there was a Sheriff's Deputy Harry Weatherford and an unknown radio operator. And then on the sixth floor, you had a Hispanic lady who was 20 years of age at the time. She was operating the radio. She had gone to Oklahoma to pick up one of the shooters, Loy Factor. And Lawrence Loy Factor was a Chickasaw Indian from Fillmore, Oklahoma. East of Ardmore. He was recruited by Mack Wallace at Sam Rayburn's funeral. And then Mack Wallace was on the sixth floor, and his job was to actually kill John Conley. I never have found out why, but that was his job.
Well, he almost got him. He was shot in the back.
He did hit him, but he didn't kill him.
I know.
And Lee Harvey Oswald was on the sixth floor, but I'm convinced he didn't touch a gun that day.
And, of course, the thing is that poor old Conley, he was part of one of the conspirators, and he had been marked for death as well. All we need to do, of course, is look at the pictures that there, and where were the Secret Service men who run beside the truck, or run beside the president's car?
Well, I recently saw a movie clip of the Secret Service running along beside the limousine as they entered Dealey Plaza, and the car behind...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Galen goes ahead and names everybody who was there at the time, the various shooters. There were a number of shooters there, and of course they were all under radio control, and of course Galen's done a wonderful job of researching this and getting the names of many of the people who were there that day, at least all that he can track down. And of course, we were talking about, you know, when you've seen the Zapruder film, you have to ask yourself, where are the Secret Service agents who run beside the president's car to protect him in case, of course, there's an effort to assassinate him? Here he's in an open car with no protection at all. Ordinarily, the Secret Service is right there. And the question is, where was the Secret Service? Galen was saying that he's seen pictures. The Secret Service were right beside the car as it entered Dealey Plaza. What happened then, Galen?
Yeah, the car right behind the president's limousine was the Secret Service, and one of the fellows in the front or in the back seat stood up just before they got to the shooting point, and he waved at the two Secret Service people trotting along beside the limousine and told them to get back, and so they both stopped and looked at him, and then raised their arms out to the right, like, what do you mean? And so shortly after that, Kennedy was killed.
And of course, what's so difficult for people to believe is that there was an organized effort on the part of the mass media, as there still is today, and then, of course, on the part of the Warren Commission to conceal the truth about what happened. Certainly four members of the Warren Commission came from the Council on Foreign Relations. Three of them were Masons. There were only seven people there. Of course, Hale Boggs, Congressman Hale Boggs, never believed the story, wanted to get the truth out, and then he went on a fateful airplane trip with a man named Begich, was actually running up for Congress up in Alaska, and his plane went down. They knew exactly where he was, and they never sent any relief at all. And we've talked to Nick Begich, the Congressman Begich's son, or to be Congressman Begich's son, and of course that's how they got rid of Hale Boggs, because he would not go along. He was on the Warren Commission. He wouldn't go along with that, and he paid with his life. So these people certainly had killed at least 100 people, probably more, who were affiliated in one way or another with the assassination, and anybody who tried to get the truth of the American people was systematically assassinated. Dorothy Kilgallen among them. And as it was a wonderful book. I think it was called The Missing Witnesses. You can find that on Craig Roberts' website. And actually, you can pull it down. The book is out of print. We used to carry it, but you can pull it down and simply on Colonel Craig Roberts' website. Did you look at all into all those people who were assassinated, who knew something about the assassination?
The
people, the number of people who were killed, mysteriously after a Jack Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, something like 100 people were killed in around Lyndon Johnson. Also, it's important to note that one of the members of the Warren Commission, John J. McCloy, was at the secret meeting at Clint Merchant's the night before. So you have a person that was directly involved as a co-conspirator involved in the Warren Commission. And 57% of the members of the Warren Commission were members of the Council of Foreign Relations, Bilderberg's, or Skull and Bones, or Trilateral Commission.
Right. But we can't let the American people understand that they really do kill heads of state. Other countries, whether it be Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, or Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, or Diem and Nguyen in Vietnam, and so many others, and also they kill American presidents as well, and people who are a threat to American presidents. It was so interesting, just this last week, the Washington, D.C. madam supposedly hung herself, you know, because she didn't want to go to prison. And we're told, she faced 55 years in prison for running a house of prostitution. Ladies and gentlemen, you could kill somebody, you could be a murderer and a rapist, and you wouldn't get 55 years in prison. I think that she knew too much. She had a list of all the politicians in Washington, D.C., who are all breathing much easier now that the Washington, D.C. madam just happened to kill herself and left two, not one, but two suicide notes. And anybody who believes that has probably believes in the Tooth Fairy as well. Is there anything else we should cover as far as the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Gail?
My number one belief of the reason for killing Kennedy is that he created silver certificates that were redeemable in silver at any federal bank.
And that was Executive Order 11110.
Yeah, and that was directly in opposition with the Federal Reserve notes that were worth zero.
Right.
So the Rothschilds and the other international bankers couldn't stand for anybody to create their own money. And so that's the main reason that Kennedy was killed, and that's the same reason that Abraham Lincoln was killed. He created greenbacks.
Amen to that.
So well, what we could... exactly the same reason.
Why don't we go ahead into the background of the murder of Abraham Lincoln? Because, of course, I don't believe we've ever gotten the true story at all. And the last thing they want the American people to understand is that anybody who wants to have an independent currency backed by gold and silver and does not want, of course, to be subservient to the European central bankers will meet a strange demise. And that's what happened to Abraham Lincoln because... when, of course, the Civil War came along, he refused to borrow money to finance the North's military efforts, and I think they wanted 20% or 30% interest. He said no, and he did the unthinkable. He simply printed money without any backing, which is, of course, what the Fed does, but that meant that they didn't have to borrow money during the Civil War to finance the North. And he paid for that with his life. Go ahead, tell the story of the murder of Abraham Lincoln, would you please?
Okay. Now the Rothschilds couldn't stand for Lincoln to create money. So before that, they had created a secret organization called the Knights of the Golden Circle, and John Wilkes Booth was a member of this group. And all of the members of the Confederate cabinet were members of the Knights of the Golden Circle.
And this was a secret society, wasn't it?
Yes.
And they were told today, oh, you don't believe in secret societies. Well, the Knights of the Golden Circle was a secret society. We never teach about that in our history books. Go ahead.
They, first of all, wanted Booth to kidnap Lincoln, and that failed, so they told him to go ahead and kill him. And so... John Wilkes Booth went to the theater and he met the guard. There's only one guard outside of the president's booth there in the theater. And he got talking to him and during the intermission invited him to go next door and have a drink with him. So after a couple of drinks while John Wilkes Booth left enough money with the bartender to keep this guard drunk. And so then he went back to the theater and into the balcony and shot Lincoln in the head and immediately jumped down to the stage and broke a bone in his foot. But he was hopping across the stage and they were trying to come get him and he pulled his knife and kept him away and was able to get out back door and got on his horse with his companion and they rode off into the night and ended up at this tobacco farm and the soldiers were following them and so the soldiers were in front of the barn main door and then they told them to come out or they were going to shoot and they thought there was only two of them in there but there's actually three. Someone was already in the barn when John Wilkes Booth and his companion arrived. And so they didn't come out, so the soldiers start shooting, and then they killed two of them. But Booth was in the back, and he went to the coast and got on a ship, sailed to England, went to London to get his final payoff. By the way, when he killed Lincoln, He had $8,000 on his in his possession, and he was an unemployed actor, so there's no way he could get that sort of money by acting. But he got his final payoff from the Rothschilds in London, and then he sailed to Bombay, India, where he died 14 years later.
Well, Chris, now, if this is really true, you would think that the average American would know about it. This would be in our textbooks, because most people think that John Wilkes Booth died there in the fire at the barn. But so how did you get the information?
Okay, there's a lady named Isola Forrester was Booth's granddaughter, and she didn't like what everybody was saying about her grandfather, and so she did a lot of research and wrote a 500-page book titled This One Mad Act. And in this, she had interviewed several of the soldiers that were there at the time of the killing. And they all said that John Wilkes Booth had red hair. Well, he actually had raven black hair. And so the fellow in John Wilkes Booth's grave has red hair, and the real grave of John Wilkes Booth in Bombay, India, the fellow has black hair. That's the real John Wilkes Booth.
And so she actually wrote the book about her grandfather, and of course nobody's ever heard the story, but she tracked him down, and of course he was allowed to escape, and of course got his payoff from the Rothschilds, and then lived out the rest of his life over in India. And the fact that most people have never heard this story simply is a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. I mean, that's really what's so frightening, is that they're able to control our reality because they control the textbooks, they control the major institutes of higher learning. You may wonder how they do that. Why, the great tax-exempt foundations, the Carnegie, Ford, and Rockefeller foundations, CFR, Carnegie, Ford, Rockefeller, working in conjunction with the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a front for a secret society. The secret society Cecil Rhodes created in 1891. How can we make that statement? Why, very simply, of course, if you read Professor Quigley's book, which we carry, suppressed for many years, but available now, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, he will tell you how the Council on Foreign Relations, page 951 and 52, is a front for the small English Roundtable Group and for J.P. Morgan. Of course, the Roundtable Group was a front for the Association of Helpers, which was a front for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created. And what was their purpose? To create a one-world government. At that time, it was to be under Great Britain, but they switched it over. Today, it is to be under the control, at least of the people here in the United States. But, of course, they intend to destroy the United States. What they really want is a ruling oligarchy. Well, let's, in the time that we have left, let's talk about the murder of Martin Luther King, because that's a fascinating part of the story as well.
Sure. Again, we have a case of a patsy, and in this case, the patsy is a fellow named James L. Ray. And James L. Ray was invited to Memphis by an undercover FBI agent named Raoul. And Raoul asked him to come there to help out on a gun deal. And so they were to meet in front of Jim's Grill across the street from the Lorraine Motel where King was killed. Well, when James L. Ray showed up, Raoul told him to go to a local gun shop and buy a rifle with a scope on it. So he did, and came back a little while with a .243 caliber rifle with a scope on it, and Raoul looked at it and says, "You idiot, take it back and exchange it for a .30-06. And, but a .243 and .30-06 are equally deadly at that range. And, but the reason they had to change it was because the real shooter was firing a .30-06. In case they recovered the bullet, they need to have a .30-06 bullet. And and there's a fellow named Jim Green that was hired by the FBI to kill James Earl Ray after the shooting took place. And he happened to be out of position when Ray came out of the flophouse above Jim's Grill and got in his Mustang and went driving off. And so Jim Green got in his car and followed right to Atlanta, where he got on the airplane, and he missed that flight, so he had to catch the next flight to Toronto. And when he got to Toronto, James Earl Ray had already left for London, and from there he went to Portugal and stayed a week or two, and then he came back to London, and I asked James, I interviewed James in prison hospital about 10 days before he died of cancer of the liver. And I asked James, why did he get caught? And he said, I ran out of money and I pulled a fool trick. I tried to, a petty crime and was arrested, and then they found out I was wanted in the United States for so-called killing of Martin Luther King, and so they extradited me. But I had an hour interview with both James Earl Ray and his brother Jerry there, and that's where a lot of my details came from.
And of course, the thing is, there's no question that James Earl Ray always denied he was involved in that crime, and yet, of course, he died in prison.
That's right.
And they couldn't let the American people know, of course, that this was another government hit to get rid of somebody that they really wanted to get rid of. Who then actually did the killing?
There's a fellow that owned Jim's Grill. His name was Lloyd Jowers. And he had a black lady as his waitress. And I also interviewed her. Her name was Betty Skates. And she told me that she was up front in the cafe and heard this noise in the back, and she thought maybe the oven blew up or something, and she went back into the kitchen, and about that time, Lloyd Jowers walked in the back door carrying a rifle. And Jowers looked at her and told her to get back up front and wait on the customers, and so she did, and so he ejected the bullet and bent it on the countertop and put it in the commode and flushed it, and but it stopped up the commode, and he had to fish it out and put it in his pocket and put it later on, threw it in the Mississippi River. But he wrapped the rifle in a tablecloth and put it on the counter and later hid it. And so the reason I know a lot of the details about this is because this fellow named Willie Aikens arrived in Memphis the day after Martin Luther King was killed. And he went to work for Lloyd Jowers as a taxi driver, and later they became friends, and then later became partners in contract killing in the Memphis area. And I interviewed Willie Aikens in the death row prison in Texas, and he told me the whole story, but he wouldn't do it on video until I got him out of prison. Of course, I couldn't get him out of prison because he was in for 30 years for possession of a kilo of cocaine. And I interviewed him four times, and each time he didn't change a word. But he said that if I could get him out, he'd not only go on video, but he would take me and show me the...
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Go right ahead.
He would show me the rifle because he knew where it was hid, because Lloyd Jowers had told him where it was. And there's some pretty tough characters involved here. Lloyd Jowers had bought this cab company from a fellow named Danny Owens. And Owens and Nate Whitlock had gone over to Lloyd Jowers' house one day, and they were gonna rough him up, and Jowers saw what was going on, and so he went and got his pistol and started shooting at him, and so they went around, hid behind the car until he ran out of bullets, and then he jumped the car and took off, but they never did bother Jowers anymore.
Well, that just goes to show you how important it is for the right people to have a right to keep and bear arms, even if they're criminals.
That's right.
The criminals have to protect themselves, too. Anyway, of course, I think the whole story is fascinating. And of course, James Earl Ray was set up as a patsy, just as Saran was set up as a patsy, as Lee Harvey Oswald was set up as a patsy, of course. They could never let the American people understand that it is a standard process of the rulers of our country to kill their opponents.
Yeah, there's another important part of this JFK, Martin Luther King killing, him guilty anyway and execute him. And also his father was escaped convict from an Oregon prison. James Gerald Ray was his name. He and his father and his brother Jerry were just petty criminals. And on the way to, I drove Jerry, his brother, from Memphis to Nashville to visit James. And on the way, I really grilled him all the way. I had him captive there for about an hour and a half. And so I'd ask him about what he thought about all this, and he says, you know, Judge Joe Brown was supposed to have this case, but they knew that he wouldn't come up with the right ending, so they threw him off the case and brought another one on. And he says, James and I have met for many judges.
Oh, that's all.
Joe Brown was about the finest judge we've ever seen.
All right. Well, anyway, our guest this evening has been Galen Ross, and thank you so much for being with us, Galen.
My pleasure, Jack.
And, of course, the book is The Elite Serial Killers. Of course, we also carry the book that Galen's written, Who's Who in the Elite, and we also carry a DVD he's done. Oh, we called American Union 2005, and it's actually the speech given by David Rockefeller, the man who really runs things here in this country. I mean, the president is power. The president is simply a figurehead for the power elite, and David Rockefeller is part of that power elite, one of the leaders of it. And, of course, it's a fascinating insight into it. I was talking. He talks for about 30 minutes on the video, doesn't he?
Yes. We got about 30, 45 minutes of David Rockefeller and three secretaries of state talking about the creation of the American Union.
And, of course, this is all part of the plan to unite the Northern Hemisphere and then unite the Southern Hemisphere and Africa and Asia. And, of course, Europe's already united. And that's how they're going to bring us into the world government. That's the plan. And is that available on DVD yet or not?
It'll be available probably in another week.
All right, fine. Well, please send us some copies. We'll be glad to carry that. We already have the video, which is available from Radio Liberty. Good night, Galen. Thanks very much for staying up to be with us.
It's always my pleasure, Stan.
All right,
God bless.
All right, fine. That's Galen Ross, of course, his book, Elite Serial Killers, a very important book. Galen has talked to so many of these people and has spent time with them, investigated this, and certainly even then, of course, we have his book, Elite Serial Killers. We have the Who's Who in the Elite, and we carry the video, be available soon in DVD, of David Rockefeller telling you what the plan was. Of course, it didn't come off. They planned to have this all in place by 2005. Fortunately, of course, they've had to put this off. Now they're planning 2010. But it doesn't matter what their time schedule is. Their ultimate goal is a new world order, a new world religion, and a new world leader, one leader, and then a ruling oligarchy to rule the world. That's what it's about, and that is, of course, what is taking place today. Well, certainly we hope that you want to get our material. You haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. If you haven't heard my talk on the forbidden secret, that's the forbidden secret, you really need to get that, because it will take you into the information behind the scenes and the spiritual forces that energize these people who embrace this idea, giving their whole lives to this idea of a one world government. And of course, you need to get my talk on the planned police state with the syllabus. There's a syllabus that goes with the forbidden secret. And of course, we have syllabuses on so many things where you get the information and the documentation. Iraq, the untold story, the story of the Iraq war, the information you'll never get any other place because it deals with all of the wars of the last century and why they were fought. And you're never going to hear this talked about. Why we really went into Iraq had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, nor did it have anything to do with preserving Israel. In fact, the policies of the American government are to destroy Israel. Why? Because Lucifer's always wanted to destroy the Jewish people, and they wanted to accumulate them there for their ultimate destruction. Well, of course, I believe that God is just, and I believe that he is going to intervene, even though the Jewish people don't necessarily deserve it, but I don't believe they're going to end up destroying Israel. I believe that the Jewish people play an important part in God's plan, just as you and I do. And you should find out what the part you are supposed to be playing, and then we hope many of you will join us in this epic struggle to determine whether America, this nation, or any other nation can long endure. And so our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, where you can listen to our programs at least 3 hours every day, 4 hours if you listen to them live, and to our satellite feed. And then, of course, we have a number of archive programs. Our programs are available on MP3. We need you to get the information. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. But pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Lynn Marzulli, who's a minister, assistant minister at a fairly large church in Southern California, and we're going to be talking about his book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. And you really can't understand much of what's going on today unless you understand that the people on the other side, and I'm talking about the people from the other who are aligned with the dark side, aligned with the Luciferian world movement, know the Bible very well. You can read the Revelation, the book of co-creation by Barbara Marx Hubbard, and this book was channeled to Barbara Marx Hubbard, one of the richest women in the world, by a spirit she called the Christ Spirit. In the original manuscript, she talked about the necessity of fulfilling the Revelation 6:8. You remember the quotation? And I look, and behold, a pale horse, and the rider upon him was death. And power was given, and Hades followed far close behind, and power was given unto them to kill a quarter of the world's population by the sword, by hunger, by pestilence, by the beasts of this world. And then she goes on to say that a quarter of the world's population will not be able to evolve to a higher level of consciousness, and they would have to be destroyed. And then she said, but that is not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse, death. And this is really what it's all about. They intend to bring about all of these things that are in the Bible, only they're going to give it a different ending. And people say that really couldn't be true. Well, I would point out that it not only could be true, it is true. It was very interesting this afternoon on our program. We had a caller named Vernon from Salinas who asked me what I thought of Lynn Marzulli's book. at politics, prophecy, and the supernatural. I said I thought it was an excellent book. That's the reason I had him on. And of course, Berlin said, you know, he'd certainly heard me interview him, and he thought that that was the most ridiculous thing he ever heard until he got the book. And that book had transformed his life and changed how he looked at everything. So, Lynn, I wanted you to know that because your book is sort of like a pebble. You drop it into a quiet pond, and there are all those ripples that go out. You never know where they're going to end. That's what's so exciting about writing a book.
Wow, Dr. Stan, that's just what a great report. Thank you so much, sir. That's great. Wow.
Well, tell us what your take is. Lots of exciting things are going on in the Near East and the Middle East, and how does this fit into biblical prophecy?
Well, I mean, we can see that the situation in the Middle East is certainly not quieting down. And there are some interesting changes, actually, in the last couple of weeks, which I think, you know, people that are following this should sort of have more of a heads up as to what's going on. Specifically, now they're saying that Iran might actually have possession of a nuclear bomb within a year. That's fairly, you know, fairly new news, as it were. We've been hearing, well, 4 years, 8 years, whatever, and now all of a sudden, because they're ramping up, and I guess it's they're hell bent for leather, pardon the expression, but they're ready to do this thing, and now they're saying like a year. So we see that this ups the ante for Israel for a possible preemptive strike.
And of course, the thing, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. As long as it's perception of people, why, of course, this is what's going to happen. Iran may never be able to develop a nuclear bomb on their own, but it doesn't matter what the truth is. What do people believe? And, of course, it's very interesting. It was just a week ago Sunday when CBS 60 Minutes put on a program interviewing people from the Israeli Air Force, talking about the fact that they are planning, in the not-too-distant future, for an airstrike on Iran, which of course will trigger, I believe, the beginning of the Third World War.
Likewise.
And we'll be back in just a moment with Lynn Marzulli. Lynn, go ahead, pick the story up there.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about where Israel is at, and we see the saber rattling now back at Iran from Israel, specifically saying that if you attack us, if you come at us, we'll basically annihilate you. They said the same thing when they talked about Damascus, when they went into Syria and wiped out, which of course now we realize was definitely some sort of a nuclear cache, whether it was a reactor or a program. They went in, it was a preemptive strike, and of course that is, they've really got Damascus over a barrel there. I mean, Assad really was caught with his pants down, and there's no doubt that nuclear material was in Syria, and of course this is a preemptive strike by the Israelis. And it basically leads to that it's not going to go away. This whole thing with Condoleezza Rice and this, you know, the quartet, and they're all trying to, you know, different people in different nations, and the quartet is, you know, the UN, the United States, Russia, and Europe, and they're all trying to say, well, it's all Israel's fault. You know, they have to stop building settlements, they have to stop doing this. I finished a book, I think last time I was on, we talked about this, fascinating book. It talks about the amount of terrorist attacks in Israel from 2000 to 2005, and I just did my own little mini survey. I went around and I just asked people randomly, give me a number. How many terrorist attacks do you think happened in that 5-year period? And what I found interesting, most people kind of thought for a second and, you know, kind of figured that the question was loaded, so they upped the ante and they said, 500, 600. And somebody else went, I think that's too low, like 1,000. And somebody else said, well, about 1,200. And the actual number is literally 25,000. Over 25,000 terrorist attacks, documented terrorist attacks against the nation of Israel from 2000 to 2005. And yet, Condoleezza Rice has the audacity to go in and tell the Israelis to take down a barricade to allow the Palestinians. And of course, if they do that, yeah, some of the people will come in and work, but the whole idea of the suicide bomber and these guys will come in and lives will be lost, and it's just a question of time. It's not going away. In fact, what we see is that the whole landscape, it's growing, things are ramping up. Bottom line is things are ramping up. And it's just a question of when they pull the trigger. It's just a question of who does what to kick the thing off. Whether it's, Israel, let's say, doing a preemptive attack on Iran, or maybe back going up into Assyria again, or is it the fact that, you know, Iran gives the nod and everybody teams up at the same time when we, and we're getting the Ezekiel 38-39 scenario, which, of course, I write about in Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, and we see that unfold. Interestingly enough, I was having a dialogue with another gentleman who doesn't believe in the Ezekiel 38-39 prophecy is set up, and he uses the prophecy that a nation...
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment here with Lynn Marzulli. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Lynn Marzulli, his book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. And of course, Lynn is talking about the fact there's something like 25,000 or more terrorist attacks on Israel during the last 5 or 6 years. 25,000 terrorist attacks, and of course an awful lot of Israelis have been slaughtered and wounded, and the people over there in Israel really will do anything at all to get peace. And we can argue back and forth that the Palestinians be fairly treated. Certainly the Palestinians have a claim to the land. We can argue all these things back and forth, but the real issue is, what about God? And we always want to leave God out of any equation. We want to leave the prophecies out of any equation. But I believe that God wants the Israelis in the Holy Land. And I believe that certainly God loves everyone. But if you're a Muslim and you convert to Christianity, they will simply kill you. I mean, this is the way the game is played over there. If you were a Muslim and you were even to sell property to a Jew, they would kill you. I mean, how do you deal with people who have this mindset? They're training their children to be suicide bombers. Mm-hmm. Everything is built upon hatred. But what everybody misses is the God part of the equation, and nobody wants to talk about that. And, of course, you can't understand anything going on in the Near East or in the Middle East unless you understand the prophecies of Ezekiel 38 and 39, which, of course, Lynn writes about in there. And, of course, what part will America play in this? What's going to happen to our country if the nations of the world move against Israel? I will tell you, in my opinion, the policy of the American government today is to destroy Israel, and they're doing everything they can to bring that about. So you pick the story up there, Lynn.
And what's interesting, of course, Dr. Stan, is even though it seems like the whole world, literally the quartet, which is you know, the four largest powers on the planet are against Israel and what they're doing. But what we see in Amos, we see prophecy in Amos saying specifically that once Israel is regathered and reestablished in its ancient homeland, of course we see that in 1948, and that prophecy of Ezekiel 37 thus being fulfilled, Amos tells us that that nation will never again be removed from Israel, from its homeland. And so, I mean, I have people that I've dialogued with and had debates on, and of course they don't believe in the prophecies, and they say, well, what happens if Israel is let's say ousted from the homeland? And my whole point is, with all the different wars that we've had over in the Middle East, specifically in Israel, where her neighbors teamed up against her, you know, I think of the 67 war, the Yom Kippur war, and others, in which, you know, a whole confederacy of nations, which is not the Ezekiel 38-39 prophecy which we're talking about, but other nations came up against Israel, and against all odds, she wins.
And certainly they never should have won the Yom Kippur War, never should have won the 67 War, never should have won the 48 War, but God, I believe, has intervened in each one of those, and you can see the hand of God in so much of what has happened.
And that's exactly what we're going to see when Iran finally pulls the trigger. There are some people who are quibbling, saying, well, it really... it's not lining up to the prophecy because Israel is not dwelling safely. Well, first of all, you know, you could say that the 25,000 terror attacks against Israel would prove that. In other words, you're saying that, well, they're really not dwelling in safely. And I would have to somewhat agree that perhaps that prophecy needs to be relooked and maybe turned over a little bit. What is interesting, though, it is still a land of unwalled villages, which was completely unheard of in the ancient world. And for the most part, it is a land that dwells in safety. I mean, people, it's not in a state of war, let's say right now. So we can quibble about the prophecy. On the other hand, what's interesting is Ezekiel 38-39, the first two nations, Magog, which many people believe is Russia, and the second nation, of course, is Iran. And those two nations are in bed with each other, in cahoots with each other, and I believe that the stage is set for the Ezekiel 38-39 prophecy to actually happen, where that confederacy of nations goes up against a land of unwalled villages, i.e. Israel. And I think we're on the cusp of it. I don't think this thing is going to go away. It's getting nastier almost by the week, You know, normally when they go for it, they go for it in the summer. In the beginning of the summer in 2007, Ahmadinejad, president of Iran, did some saber-rattling saying that there's going to be a regional war this summer, speaking of the summer of 2007. It didn't happen. Interesting, like he's already talking about a regional war. So when this thing goes, I mean, they're going to throw everything at the Israelis. They're going to try to wipe them off the face of the earth. And what's interesting for your readers, and I get into this in Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, that this is really foreign to the Western mindset, and it comes from Islam. And Islam teaches specifically, and you know, people who are listening to this can try to prove me wrong, but it's a little bit of research, and you'll find out very quickly that in Islam, they are taught, the children are taught, that Jews are descendants from pigs and monkeys. That's what they're taught. So right off the bat, how do you try to sit down with people who believe that, first of all, you're inferior and that you're descendants from you know, apes and pigs? I mean, how do you sit down and have any type of a dialogue? And this is why they want to kill every Jew. This is the Quran says in one of its verses. I forget which verse, but I can basically quote it, and the paraphrase is simply this, that there will come a time in the Islamic world where the trees will cry out and say, oh, Muslim, there's a Jew behind this, quickly, hiding here. Come quickly and kill him. With that kind of vitriol that you're taught from just, you know, from the time you can begin to understand words, I mean, where do you go from there? There's just no wiggle room. And, of course, this same mindset, even though the Third Reich was not Muslim, but the same mindset was used by the Nazis, you know, that these people are somehow, the Jews specifically, are somehow subhuman. They're not quite human. They're, it also dovetails with Darwinism, survival of the fittest, that we need to breed them out of the human race. And so that's why the Holocaust happened and the 6 million Jews that were slaughtered. And the same mindset is migrated into the Middle East, and we see the exactly, or very close, similarity between Europe in 1939, right before Hitler came to power, and Iran. In fact, Benjamin Netanyahu has quoted, and I quote this verbatim, it's 1939 and Iran is Germany. And the world really needs to wake up and see that we're poised. We're right on the cusp of this, what I believe is the fulfillment of the Ezekiel 38-39 prophecy, which again speaks of a confederacy of nations coming up against the land of unwalled villages. And Israel will respond by using its neutron bomb, its nuclear force. It's the only option that they'll have. They actually have that. We've talked about this a little, Dr. Stan. They actually have it. It's called the Samson option. And in Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, I referred to that and did some research on it, and it's fascinating. They actually have a whole set of scenarios, and one of them is a Samson option. If they're backed up into a corner, if they're about to be overrun by invading armies, they will use their neutron bomb. They will use their nuclear arsenal, which is very sobering indeed.
And of course, basically, of course, there are about 50,000 missiles that are aimed at this little tiny country, you know. That, of course, Hezbollah has been reinforced, Hamas has been reinforced, Iran has missiles that can actually hit that area, and I'm sure that Syria does as well. And so all of these missiles, I mean, you know, some places Israel's only 8 miles wide. And, of course, it just extends along the coast there. And America, of course, through the Oslo Accord and through other agreements, has forced Israel to give up land time after time after time. Oh, if you just give up land, you can have peace. And that's what they told them. They gave up the Sinai, and that's what they told them. That they gave up Gaza, and they gave up the West Bank. And, of course, every time they, of course, give up land, why, of course, there's more violence against the Israeli people. Is it fair? Is anything over there fair? Absolutely not. There is no fairness here, but this, of course, is where I believe the final battle, or one of the final battles, certainly the battle laid out in Ezekiel 38 and 39, is not the Battle of Armageddon. You must understand that. They are different battles, but the prophecies that are laid out there, it's well worthwhile reading it, and you can see all of these lands. They talk about, of course, Saudi Arabia, they talk about Egypt, they talk about Libya, they talk about Ethiopia. They're all named in the scriptures there, if not by name, so you can figure out what they are. And it appears that this whole great consortium of nations is coming against Israel, this little tiny country that was reformed in 1948 after having been really disappeared since 70 AD. That was the last time that Israel existed as a nation. And then, of course, for almost 2,000 years, it was extinct. And now, certainly, I believe, by God's guidance, it has been reformed. And people will say, well, it was the Zionists that did it. Well, I don't care who did it. I believe, of course, God is supreme, and he directs all things. And if you understand that, why it's so much easier to see what's going on. And you see God's hand in literally everything going on there in the Middle East. In fact, even the monetary unit they have, the shekel, had not existed for thousands of years. And suddenly, all prophesied in the Old Testament that when the land was reconstituted, the monetary unit would be the shekel, and it is. And of course,
phenomenal.
If really, there's so many things that have taken place, and I'm sure Lynn, as an ordained minister, knows this a lot better than I do, but all of the, really the miraculous prophecies, even dealing with the Israeli people, I mean, it all points to God's hand in this, don't you believe?
You know, Dr. Stan, it's just astounding. If a little bit of research will show that the land actually did not have what's called the latter rains. The latter rains did not fall for almost 2,000 years. Right after AD 70, when Titus came in and razed the city, and which signaled the diaspora, the scattering of the Jews amongst the nations, there was no latter rain for centuries. Centuries went by without the latter rain, plus great earthquakes and a plague of locusts would come. So that's why when Mark Twain writes about that no one was settling there and the place was desolate, it's true, it was desolate.
In fact, we actually have some pictures that were painted back in the 1800s by an American done in watercolors, and you see all the land around Israel. There's nothing there. There's no forest. There's no trees. No nothing. Everything is barren in the 1800s, and now of course you go there and forests, massive forests all over, and all a reflection, of course, of I believe God's divine hand in reestablishing the nation of Israel, which plays such an important part in the end time prophecies. We're going to be back in just a moment with Pastor Lynn Marzulli. Okay, Lynn, of course, these are exciting times, and of course, which of the countries are, it seems that mainly most of the countries over there in the Middle East are going to be moving against Israel before very long. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think everything's ramping up. You know, as you talked about, that Hamas has been complete, or Hezbollah in the north has been rearmed. And we know that for a fact. You know, Israel went in 2006 and pushed them back and definitely destroyed some of their forward positions, but nothing has changed, and all they've done is rearm themselves, and it's just a question of when they all go at it, and they will go at it. I mean, the vitriol, it's just, I mean, it kind of defies our mindset over here. It's kind of hard for most people in the West to get their heads around the fact that these people, and I'm speaking specifically of the radical wing of Islam, the jihadists, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Iranians, and even some Iraqis for that matter, and certainly the Syrians, the same thing. It's at all costs, they must remove Israel at all costs. I mean, Ahmadinejad has gone on the record saying that he'd be willing to sacrifice a third of his own people to bring that about. It's hard to understand. That type of vitriol, that type of just blatant hatred for a group of people. And what's amazing, as we were talking about right before the last break there, that, you know, when you look at Mark Twain's account of Israel when he's there, how completely denuded the entire country was. The Turks came in and cut down every single tree for the Turkish railroad, that had been growing there, then salted the earth. I mean, nothing grew. As I talked about, there was like plagues of locusts that would come up. By the way, there's plagues of locusts right now in Africa, but that's another story. But again, that leads into modern day prophecy and, you know, plagues and famines and rumors of war. And I mean, all these things together, when you begin to get an overview, the fact that, you know, wars and rumors of wars are happening globally, that these plagues and these famines are happening globally. I mean, millions of people are being killed and displaced because of famine, because of plague. The AIDS virus has killed over 40 million people in Africa. And you start to piece this stuff together and look at it in the light and through the lens of prophecy. And one begins to realize, in my opinion, that we are literally in the last of the last days, that this thing is coming to a close. And, you know, Jesus says something really interesting, Dr. Stan. In Luke 21, he says, you know, when you see wars and rumors of wars and famines and this stuff, look up, for your redemption is coming. In other words, I'm coming back, the second coming. And so it's even though we look at these things and they can be unsettling, to say the least, no one wants to see a nuclear conflagration and thousands or hundreds of thousands of people die like Nagasaki or Hiroshima. But nevertheless, all these things are going to happen, not because the Lord wants them to happen, because he's allowing man to run the way he wants to run as far as he possibly can before the Lord comes back and says enough. But all these things are birth pangs for the second coming. And this is why it's almost like a quickening, if I can use that word. Art Bell, you coined that a while back. But in my opinion, it's true. It's accurate. There is a quickening, and we see the signs, and things are moving faster. I mean, technology, Daniel talks about knowledge will increase, and men will run to and fro over the face of the earth. I mean, like, if you look at that prophecy, let's say 100 years ago, you'd say, well, you know, I don't know what that means. You know, knowledge will increase. Well, knowledge really hadn't increased 120 years ago. Yeah, you got the Industrial Revolution, but it's just a little blip on the map, so to speak.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lynn Marzulli, and he's just talking about these prophecies from ancient times. And, you know, of course, if you talked 100 years ago about the Jews returning to the Holy Land, people would look at you and say, that's crazy talk. You know, the Jews, they've been dispersed for almost 2,000 years. And then, of course, Lynn was pointing out that this prophecy, end-time prophecy, a phenomenal increase in knowledge. And, of course, as you know, that knowledge is doubling almost every 6 months or so. Knowledge is doubling almost every 6 months or so. Understand, of course, that this has never happened before throughout all mankind. Certainly when my mother and dad were brought up, I mean, the automobile had just come in, the airplane. When my mother was born, there were no airplanes. When my mother was born, the major means of transportation was still horseback, as it had been at the times of ancient Rome. And look what's happened in the intervening years. I think she was born about 1893, look, here we suddenly have automobiles, we have airplanes, we have computers, we have nanotechnology. Well, you go ahead and pick this story up there.
And you see, Dr. Stan, it's like if we just look at one of those things, and this is the problem that most people, and even in Christian circles, they're not taught the whole counsel of God, and so a lot of Christians don't understand what the prophecies are because no one's taught them, no one's talked about it. And what's great about a show like this is at least we can whet their appetite and get them into the Word and to show them what these prophecies are talking about. Now, if you just take the one that we talked about in Daniel, that, you know, knowledge will increase and men will run to and fro over the face of the earth, and we realize that prophecy, nothing really changed until the Industrial Revolution hit in the latter part of the 19th century. And then, of course, into the 20th century, things just began to increase, as you pointed out, and exponentially so, to the fact that where knowledge is increasing every 6 months is basically doubling, which is true. We're constantly moving. You know, we communicate at the speed of light through the Internet. I mean, these things, the technology, the world that we live in, the modern world is absolutely astounding. It really is. It's just, it's an unbelievable time to be alive. But on the other hand, in my opinion, it triggers for the student of prophecy. It's just like the handwriting on the wall, if I can use that analogy and go back to Daniel again. But literally, we see that mankind is moving at this just rapid speed. But in tandem with that, we also see plagues, wars, and rumors of wars unlike any other time in history. There are like wars all over this planet. Not like World War II, but these little mini skirmishes, and they're everywhere. All these little tribal wars, and like, just look what's happening over in Darfur. You've got the plague of AIDS, which has devastated the African continent, and other plagues and other diseases that we see. And we see this weather with the, you know, tornadoes killing 10,000 people. I mean, that's just unheard of, you know, and it's like you start to take all these things together, you know, and look at them, and we begin to realize that the jig is up. That we're moving into the time that the Bible speaks of more than any other, the time of Jacob's trouble, where the Antichrist is going to rear his ugly head, that this idea of a one-world government and a one-world religious system will take place on the planet, which really moves us into, if you want to go there, Dr. Stan, into the supernatural. Because in my opinion, which is the third leg of the book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, The Coming Great Deception of a Luciferian Endgame, the Bible very specifically tells us in the book of Revelation that there will be a one-world economic system and a one-world religious system, which, of course, begs the question, especially in our age, how the heck can you get 1.2 billion, with a B, billion Muslims to somehow change their worldview? Or for that matter, in 2 Thessalonians, it talks about that the man of sin will not be revealed until the great falling away happens, the apostasy happens. When this thing comes down, it's very, very deliberate. People make a very deliberate choice, and it's a willful falling away from the truth. And, of course, what is the truth? The truth is that Jesus is the Son of God, that was born of a virgin, died on the cross, 3 days later, rose again from the dead. That's the shorthand version of it. That's what we believe as Christians. What happens if an event happens on this planet unlike any other event that we've ever seen? What can change people's worldview, you know, in almost a nanosecond, if I can use that term? What can change people's worldview? What could change 1.2 billion Muslims or millions of Christians to abandon their faith? And, of course, in my opinion, it's the extraterrestrial revealing of the so-called extraterrestrial present, which is nothing more than the demonic being revealed, which will become the Great Deception.
And I think that's really so important. You know, whenever we talk about, of course, UFOs and those aliens, people who believe in aliens, no, ladies and gentlemen, that is, of course, that is to deceive you. They know that these are demonic beings. They don't want the American people to know, of course, about the true nature of the spirits of battle. There really are, of course, demonic beings that exist within our society that have actually gone from one dimension to the other. We'll be back in just a moment here with Lynn Marzulli. And welcome your calls, incidentally. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Lynn Marzulli, and Lynn is talking about how, of course, as we began looking at things going on today, and they're puzzling, they're frightening, and yet, of course, he feels, as I do, there is a supernatural element to everything going on today. And Lynn was simply pointing out that what is going to get people to change their worldview? What's going to get the Muslims to change their attitude towards their fundamental beliefs? What's going to get Christians to change their attitude? Of course, the Muslims are waiting for the return of the Mahdi, and he is like a Messiah to them. He is going to, of course, come and bring them, of course, into a ruler. They are going to rule the world through the Mahdi, and the Christian, certainly the Jew, believes, of course, the Messiah is coming. Christians believe Jesus Christ is coming. They can't all be right. And I believe, of course, that the truth is that Jesus Christ is going to be coming again. But certainly I think we're going to see many, many things that deceive us in the meantime. So you pick up the story.
Well, thanks, Dr. Stan. I think we are going to see, as the Bible talks about, Satan coming with all signs and lying wonders, that the elect would be deceived if that were possible. You know, I keep harping on these scriptures, and I keep bringing them up to the church. Because, in fact, I had a dialogue with a gentleman over the weekend who was, telling me, basically, he's going, well, you know, the theology behind the whole Nephilim, that's really not accepted in most theological circles. And I said, well, excuse me, sir, I beg to differ with you. Because in many circles, the whole idea of in the Nephilim on the earth and the Genesis account, the B'nai Elohim is always translated fallen angels. I'm aware of the Sethite view, and I understand that, and it's taught in some seminaries, and the other seminaries teach that the fallen angels, or the sons of God, in fact, are the fallen angels. So there are two schools of thought, and I'm aware of that. But what's interesting is, like, we're so quick to jump on our theological high horse, so to speak, and yet we have all these different denominations, let's say. Certain denominations believe that the signs and wonders are only for the apostolic age. And other denominations believe, of course, that signs and wonders, the gift of healing, the gift of tongues, are for the modern age. So we see we have a difference in theological viewpoints. And to say that the whole idea of Nephilim is weak theologically, to me, just doesn't hold water, especially when you have people like Dr. I.D.E. Thomas and Dr. Patty Heron, Dr. Tom Horn, and yourself, Dr. Stan. I mean, it's just like you have scholars all over the place who have, Chuck Missler is another one, have written many books on the subject, and I think we've nailed it home that the sons of God, the B'nai Elohim, can only be translated fallen angels.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with Lynn. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lynn Marzulli. We're talking about his book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. Lynn, why don't you get your website out there and tell our listeners how they can get copies of your book. And
I love it, Dr. Stan. The website is Spiral of Life, www.spiral, like a DNA spiral or a spiral staircase, www.spiralofLife, spiralofLife.com. You can go there and order the book. Also, you might want to sign up for the monthly newsletter. It's there's three sections, politics, prophecy, and the supernatural. I usually do interviews with different people on different a variety of subjects. Last month we had a wonderful interview on the Shroud of Turin by a Scientologist, a man who studied the Shroud for about 30 years. It was just a fascinating article, and you can sign up for that and get the monthly newsletter. But that's the website, or you can call 310-457-5564 and place your order by phone. That's 310-457-5564.
Well, our telephone number, if you'd like to call here, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And you know, the difficulty we face today is that most people are trying to look at everything rationally. And, of course, you can't think about things rationally when we're, of course, talking about what's happening in the spiritual realm. Because I believe between man's plan and time and God's plan and eternity, there's an infinite quality of difference. And we don't look at the world the way God looks at the world. We don't look at things right and wrong the way he looks at them. And he has a plan. I believe, of course, it's being played out today. And we are, whether you want to or not, you're going to have to acknowledge someday that we are not going to determine what's going to happen. He is going to determine what's going to happen. And I think that he knew before the beginning of time what was going to be happening today and what people were going to be doing. And our job, of course, is to try to be in God's will and try to get people to understand the true nature of the spiritual battle, because we're talking about eternity for millions of people whose souls are going to be lost. Within the Christian church today, there's a tremendous stress on mysticism. Oh, you want to experience God. You want to walk the labyrinth. You want to meditate on a word over and over again. All you have to do is say this prayer or this word, and now you're going to know God. And ladies and gentlemen, this is not the way that it works. This is what was tried thousands of years ago by certainly in the Catholic Church, and the curse that the monks who flayed themselves and through pain were going to know God. I don't believe God wants any of us to come to him that way. I think he wants us to come to him in simple faith. And the faith comes from hearing the word of God. And, of course, faith comes from hearing and hearing from the word of God. So pick up the story there.
Well, you know, Dr. Stan, we're talking about the supernatural. And we're talking, I was trying to get into the whole subject of UFOs and the idea that when the fallen angels came the first time, there was an exchange. In other words, they really wanted some sort of a genetic experiment. Tom Horn, in his book, gets into it, and of course, in Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, I, you know, touch on it and get into it, in the sense that we see that these fallen angels apparently came down, they had sex with the women of Earth, and the offspring were the Nephilim. This, of course, results in the flood of Genesis, which we all know, the flood of Noah. What's interesting is, Jesus himself says something very, very enigmatic. He says, as in the days of Noah, so it will be when the Son of Man returns. And which begs the question, what differentiates the days of Noah than any other time in history? And there is only, as far as I know, there's really only one event which differentiates and sets apart the days of Noah than any other time in history, and that is the presence of the fallen angels. Are we seeing that manifestation of the fallen angels today? And are they disguising themselves in a different way? In other words, the end game, of course, is deception. Jesus says himself, you know, anyone deceive you. And, of course, Dr. Thomas, in his book, The Omega Conspiracy, really is, in my opinion, one of the first Christian authors to make the link between the Genesis 6 phenomena and that of the current UFO flaps and the abduction scenario phenomena which is happening, and the cattle mutilation, the crop circles, it's all part of the same demonic delusion. And you see, the thing is, if you saw a 3 mile, and I'm speaking rhetorically here, Dr. Stan, but if any of your listeners saw a 3 mile wide UFO hovering over their city, guess what? Your worldview is going to be really shaken. And it's, in my opinion, and this is based on 20 years of research, and in politics, prophecy, and the supernatural, there's 25 pages of footnotes. So if you have a problem with what I'm saying, look at my sources and, you know, write me a letter and let's iron sharpen iron, prove me wrong. The bottom line is the phenomena isn't going away. There are 10,000 UFO sightings per year. If just 4 or 5 of these things are real, what are we looking at, folks? And I just did an interview with a gentleman in Texas, and some of your listeners may be familiar with this, but about 2 or 3 months ago, 2.5 months ago, there was a huge, major UFO flap down in Stephensville, Texas. It's just a little bit southwest of Dallas, about an hour outside of Dallas. In fact, the History Channel sent their UFO hunters down, and they actually did a triangulation from 3 different witnesses, and they pinpointed where this craft that these 3 separate witnesses saw, you know, from 3 different parts of the city. They were able to figure out where the craft was, and they were able to go to not only the military but commercial aircraft and prove that there was no aircraft in that area during that time. What was interesting for me is I got to talk with a gentleman who saw what I would describe, and of course Stan Friedman described it as a mothership. And these are just some notes from the interview that I did, which is in the monthly newsletter. But this is my first lead-off question. Can you describe for us what you saw? And this is, the gentleman answers, it was almost at the top of the tree. It was huge. At one point, I looked over my head and felt vulnerable. It had cones. They were going up into the craft, inverted cones. The bottom of each was about 10 feet wide. The top was less than 5 feet. It was really big. I couldn't see the end of it. When I looked as far as I could, look to my right, as far as I could look to my left, it was as far out as I could see, straight out from me, no shadows. That was the strange part. When I first saw it, my brain was jumping all over the place. I had to slow my mind down to study the craft, only thing I could do. That's how he answers it. I've talked to this guy, Dr. Stan, about a half a dozen times, and he's always the same. He's real down home, real simple guy. He seems to be real straightforward. I wasn't there. I don't know what the gentleman saw. I do believe what he saw something, and whatever it was has literally changed this guy's life. And from his description, this thing was at least a mile and a half to 2 miles wide, based on, and I'm being conservative. He thinks it's more like 3 miles wide, so I'm being conservative. And the bottom line is, you know, we're getting hints of this stuff. We got one from Stephensville, Texas. We had another one over the English Channel last summer. 2 separate pilots, 2 different aircraft, you know, thousands of hours between these 2 guys, and, you know, and they realize that if they say UFO, they could be, you know, they could lose not their license, but they might lose their job, which has happened, especially over in this country. Both pilots went on the record say we saw a craft that was 3 miles wide, roughly 3 miles wide. And, you know, if just one of these things begin to, you know, reveal themselves, it's going to change people's worldview. And this is the scenario I outlined in Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. Is this the scenario? Is this what's going to happen, which will cause this great falling away? Is this, in fact, the manifestation of what 2 Thessalonians talks about, all signs and lying wonders? You know, we read these things, Dr. Stan, and the church looks at this stuff, and we just kind of turn the page. Oh, all signs and lying wonders. I have no clue what that means. I'm not going to think about it. I'm just going to turn the page and get my cookies ready for the bake sale, which is all fine and dandy. But the more we look at what's manifesting on the planet, what's happening right now, real time, what's manifesting? You've got the abduction scenario, which is in every country on the planet, where women are abducted and sometimes men. There are gynecological examinations done that are painful. There are forceful impregnations. The sperm is taken from men. Eggs are taken from women. Sometimes the women are impregnated, and the 3 months later, the first trimester, the baby is then taken out, and then sometimes years later, and I actually have interviewed these so-called abductees, and the woman saw her hybrid baby like 5 or 6 years later. She was presented with this little girl, and it wasn't entirely human. Now, I realize for your listeners who have never traveled in this stuff, this is bizarre stuff. But what does it point back to? It points back to Genesis 6, when the Nephilim were on the earth, and also afterwards. And what most people don't realize is Goliath, right? Goliath was a Nephilim. When you read Josephus, Josephus talks about that the bones of a Nephilim, Josephus is a first century Jewish historian, and he talks about that the bones of a Nephilim were openly on display at the time of his writing. And these guys were huge, sometimes 12 to 15 feet tall. They were huge. This is why, you know, the people talk about Goliath, but Goliath was a Nephilim. And this is why no one would come up against this guy. They were terrified of him. Not only was a giant, but he was literally a demonic hybrid. He was part man, but also part demon, which is really bizarre, part fallen angel. When you really start thinking about it, it's really bizarre. And, of course, what are we seeing today? What's manifesting on the planet? Cattle mutilations, crop circles, 10,000 UFOs sighted per year. And now we're getting flaps like Stevensville and the one over the English Channel where we see three-mile-wide craft manifesting. And when this thing kicks off, and, of course, I believe this is my scenario, this is what is written in Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, that the supernatural part of this is going to kick in right after the Ezekiel 38-39 war. When they go at it in the Middle East and Israel uses its neutron bomb to annihilate, and the scripture says decimate, so that's down to one-tenth, only one-tenth will be remaining of the invading army. And all hell will literally break loose at that point. And what I mean by that is we will see the manifestation of these craft, I believe, over the cities of the earth. And I know that that sounds just like some sci-fi movie like Independence Day, but the evidence is overwhelming. You know, people who have traveled in this stuff for 20, 30 years, it's like it's not going away. It's burgeoning. It seems to be ramping up for a climax. And what the abductees will tell you is that these so-called aliens, which, of course, Dr. Stan and I believe are nothing more than demons masquerading as such, they tell us that we'll show you who God really is. They're very, very interested in, like, eschatology. In other words, how would they know about this stuff, you know? Or, you know, in one of my books I write, if they really cared about us, why not give us the cure to cancer? You know, why not do something good? But they don't. They're always, like, talking about the idea that the world is going to come to an end and we're going to destroy ourselves, and they're here to set things right, that they genetically manipulated. This is what the aliens are saying, the so-called aliens, that they genetically manipulated us from primitive humans 20 to 30,000 years ago. That day the aliens were responsible for all the miracles of the Bible, okay? Now, you may say, Lynn, that's just completely ridiculous. You know, what have you been smoking? And I will tell you, listener, that there is a Presbyterian minister, his name is Barry Gooding Jr., and he has written a book, and in that book, he's right on board with this stuff. He believes that all the miracles of both the Old and the New Testament were caused, I'm not making this stuff up, Dr. Stan, footnotes are in the book, that were caused by direct extraterrestrial intervention. In other words, Moses parting the Red Sea, E.T. Jesus walking on water, E.T. Feeding of the 5,000, E.T. Resurrection after 3 days in the tomb, E.T. All the miracles of both the Old and New Testament are attributed to extraterrestrial intervention. So he's already on board with what I call is the coming great deception. This event will shake people's worldviews, and unless a person is really rooted and grounded and knows the Lord personally, has that, you know, indwelling of the Holy Spirit, God's Spirit in them, born again in the Spirit, they too will be deceived. Jesus' own words, even the elect would be deceived if that were possible. I mean, what are we talking about here, folks? I'm not making this stuff up. If it's not this, then you tell me what else it could be. What else is manifesting on the planet? What is, you know, the enemy ramping up for? And I have not been able to discover anything else but this.
Well, I certainly agree with you. The interesting thing is, of course, I read some of the Luciferian material. I read a Share magazine, something called The Emergence, put out by Benjamin Krem, who is affiliated with this, and they talk about the same things. They talk about the crop circles, the cattle mutilations, these supernatural events that see, you know, somebody can see the Virgin Mary and a grilled cheese sandwich, things of that sort, and of course, they talk about the weeping virgins, the weeping weeping statues. And actually, people go there and they actually see the tears, the blood, bloody tears. These are supernatural manifestations. Now, some of this, of course, is could be fraudulent, but some of it, I believe, is actually true. But I believe it is not of our Lord Jesus Christ. I believe it is things to lead people away from the truth. And this is the big problem, is that so much is being done to confuse us. So we get off on this track or the other track. Certainly, it's a fascinating thing to think about these alien abductions. There's a Dr. Mark or something like that back at Harvard, who's documented, the Department of Psychiatry, 5,000 alien abductions. And the people all have the same basic story. Certainly, Chuck Missler's written a wonderful book on alien abductions. Have you read that?
Yes, I have.
And, of course, he talks about how, of course, all of these people who have been abducted are into the New Age and occultism. You don't find this among Christians, born-again Christians, but you do find it about those who do not know the Lord. And, of course, at that point, they are seemingly susceptible to these demonic beings. And, of course, the only thing that's really going to protect them in the future is a personal relationship with our Lord. That's the only force we have. But, of course, we have, as individuals, the power to call upon the blood of Jesus to counter these demons. And if we don't do that, if we don't know what to do, of course, they can plague us and they can actually destroy us. And if necessary, if they want to, they can kill us. They have supernatural power. But we have the power of the Lord. The only protection we have is not of our own power, our own ability, but of our Lord Jesus Christ. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Lynn Marzulli. We're talking about his book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. And there is so much evidence of the supernatural influence on society today. And remember, when, of course, they give you the idea that government's concealing things, they're keeping it from you, they don't want you to know about the aliens. That's the question to make you to believe it is the aliens. It's not aliens at all. It is demonic manifestations of this supernatural force that is there, the other dimension. And, of course, Tom Corn has written a wonderful book. It's called Stargate. And, of course, this is the people who've tried to pierce to the other dimension. And some of them claims they have. Now, Ron Hubbard's claimed that he had, and other of the people leading false religions claim that they were actually able to, well, Aleister Crowley claimed that they actually were able to get into the other dimension. It's an excellent book going along with what Lynn has written. Stargate, we carry that, and of course you can get Lynn's book. One more time, the telephone number. Call.
Thanks, Dr. Stan, 310-457-5564.
One more time.
310-457-5564 or spiraloflife.com.
That's spiraloflife.com, www.spiraloflife.com. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, then, you've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program. You go right ahead.
Dr. Stan, I really appreciate you having me on. And just thank you so much for, the time that you allow me to talk about what I find is just the most passionate subject I can possibly delve into. But just for your listeners, keep an eye on the Middle East. There's many websites I go to every day to get my news from, a lot of Israeli websites, but also some Muslim websites, which are really interesting, and different Middle Eastern websites. And when you start, when people start to look at the overview of really what's happening and how unstable the world is, and we talked earlier in the program about the plagues and the famines and the wars and the rumors of wars and how this dovetails with prophecy, we are living in the last days. And I know some people have heard this for, 10, 15 years, and people have talked about this, but we must realize that the coming great deception is in Jesus' own words, the elect would be deceived. I always go back to that. Jesus himself is telling us that unless those days were shortened, no flesh would survive. What is coming is unbelievable, and the deception that is coming on this planet will affect every man, woman, and child. And unless you know, I mean, this gentleman I interviewed with the Stevensville, Texas thing, I mean, he's still trying to deal with what he looked at. I sent him my book, he's read it, but he's still not sure what he, because it's overwhelming. In his own words, when you see something like that, it changes everything. All bets are off. It fractures your worldview unless you're prepared and you instantly rebuke it in the name of the Lord, because you know it's a deception that you're looking at. And that's why I wrote the book. That's why I'm on shows like yours, Dr. Stan, and I talk about it till I'm blue in the face, to warn the body of Christ what is coming on the earth.
And I think what we need, of course, is people on the front lines of this trying to educate Christians. The great tragedy is most Christians do not really understand the prophecies because they haven't been taught them. They do not understand how those prophecies dovetail with the events that are taking place today. And the fact that we are on the edge of cataclysmic events that I think are going to shape the course of history and, of course, may well lead to the demise of the utopian society we exist in. But our job is, of course, to be truthful, to be faithful to the Lord and keep our eyes fixed on Him, because when things become impossible, the only hope we have, of course, is our personal relationship with our Lord.
Boy, said it really good there, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Well, I guess our guest has been Lynn Marzulli. His book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. And, of course, we'll hope to have Lynn on our program. Lynn, if anything exciting comes up you want to talk about, give me a call. We'll always try to get you.
Certainly will, Dr. Stan. Thank you for the open forum, sir.
Good night. God bless.
Night. God bless you.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Lynn, because I think that he's right on. I believe that you cannot understand what's happening politically unless you understand the prophecies. And I don't think you can understand the prophecies unless you understand the supernatural dimension. This is the demonic dimension. It's the supernatural dimension where the angels and, of course, the demons are fighting and struggling for the souls of men. And this, of course, is an element which most people don't even believe in. And yet, of course, if you're a Christian, you have to believe in the supernatural. I mean, how could Jesus have walked on water? How could Jesus have turned water into wine? How could he have materialized in a locked room? How could he have risen from the dead? How could he have raised others from the dead? There has to be a supernatural dimension and supernatural forces there, and our job is the story of the feeding of the 5,000. There are so many stories out there in the Bible, and if you believe the Bible, you have to believe those stories. You can't, I'm going to take what I want to, or I'll take this and that, but I'll reject those other things. You have to accept the Bible is telling you the truth. So we do hope that many of you out there will enjoy our programs, and if you want to get the complete text of what we talk about, because Lynn and I do talk when, of course, the advertisements are coming on. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to. It will help to introduce you to this whole story. If you can't afford to buy it, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, RadioLiberty.com, and you can watch the DVD from which the book actually came, a talk I'd given in Granada form in the late 1990s, but it's an important story. And then, of course, you need to understand the forbidden secret, the secret that has been passed down for 5,000 years. Rhonda Burns talked about that secret on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And, of course, she's written a book called The Secret, put out a DVD called The Secret. So, I mean, there's 7 million copies, I think, of the book were out there. But if you have to understand that what she's telling you is absolutely true, there is a secret. There is a power there that you can tap into. But, ladies and gentlemen, you don't want to tap into that power because, of course, you are risking your eternal soul. We need to know it's there, but certainly we need to caution people to stick to the scriptures, not to be looking for some mystical experience or how we can manipulate God. You know, name it and claim it. Somebody once said, all these ministers, you know, would tell us to name it and claim it and God will provide it. Why are they all always asking us for money? Have you ever wondered if this is such a great means of getting money, as God will provide it for you? Why do these ministers bother to take up a collection? Well, of course, there's a lot of insincerity out there. We need to stick to the scriptures. You need to find a Bible-believing church that sings the old hymns and is not trying to lead you into this new type of religion. This new experiential Christianity, and that has nothing to do with Christianity. Everything you need is simply written in the scriptures. You need, of course, to get my material, my talk, and the syllabus called The Planned Police State, because, of course, that takes you not only to the plan for the dictatorship in America, which is coming, but it will also take you into the supernatural element that is inspiring everything that's going on. We do hope many of you want to get our material on concentration camps, not imaginary, but really very real. We have a 4-tape set on concentration camps. We have a DVD on concentration camps. You'll actually see them with your own eyes. You'll actually want to get the, of course, if you get the concentration camp special, you get the amazing clips, and you'll see the Iran-Contra hearings where they tried to bring out the truth about the concentration camps. And, of course, Congressman Jack Brooks was silenced by Senator, in a way, because the last thing they want is the American people.